All attendees are in listen-only mode.
Welcome to today's Journal Club webinar. My name is Rachel Dager. I'm the Associate Executive Director of SNEB and glad to have you with us today. Just a little bit of housekeeping to get us started. If you look in the GoToWebinar toolbar, there should be the slides available as a handout for you to download and follow along. We will take questions at the end of the presentation, so please type those in the question block, and we will moderate those to our presenter. When we close out the webinar today, there's a short survey, and we appreciate your feedback on this session as well as ideas for future webinars. And then just a reminder that I'll get an email out by Wednesday of this week with a link to the recording, the slide handout, as well as the CEU certificate that you're earning with your attendance today. We have a guest moderator today who actually is not Sarah Colby, who was our first guest moderator, who is unable to join us. So Virginia Stage is our moderator today. She is the Assistant Professor of Nutrition Science at East Carolina University.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for being on the webinar with us today. I want to introduce our speaker, Dr. Lisa Kakanami, received her PhD in epidemiology from the University of Rochester. She's currently an assistant professor in the Department of Mathematics and Statistics in collaboration with the Perform Center at Concordia University in Montreal, Quebec. Her research is aimed at improving our understanding of the determinants of childhood obesity, focusing on poverty, social familial factors, and behaviors, and empirically testing the methodological tools used in identifying obesity. Thank you for being with us today. Introducing now Dr. Kakanami.
Thank you so much. Thank you, everyone, for coming today. And I know, I believe there's supposed to be a chat session at the end for questions, but if you have any clarification questions, I'm happy to take those throughout the presentation as well. So today I want to talk a little bit about an article that I published with a few co-authors earlier this year in the Journal of Nutrition Education and Behavior. And in this article, we looked at the associations of parentals' nutritional label use and their label literacy, as well as their knowledge in terms of how that related to their not only their cardiometabolic risk factors, but in their children as well. So I'll start with some background about nutrition labels and how they are used in the U.S., and I'll primarily speak about our publication that was done earlier this year, and then we can open the floor up to questions. So just so we're all on the same page, I just wanted to go over a brief background in terms of what nutrition labels are and what they contain. So in general, when we talk about nutrition labels, we're talking about these labels here that include between 2 to 3 components. The first component here would be the nutrition facts table, as shown here on the bottom left. And then an ingredient list, which is also mandatory if the food item has at least more than one ingredient, shown here in the middle. And then the third component is more optional, and it really depends on if the food product makes some sort of nutrient content or health claim, such as having reduced fat, or if it's all natural, then they need to also include this information on there as well. Moving forward, though, I may sometimes use nutrition facts table interchangeably with nutrition labels, because this is really the key component in terms of what people use to decide what kind of food products they purchase and use. So believe it or not, nutrition labels and nutrition facts tables have been mandatory in the U.S. on all packaged foods since 1990 due to what's known as Nutrition Labeling and Education Act. And this essentially gave the FDA the authority to require these labels on all packaged foods and that they were that were being regulated by the FDA. Part of this act was to also help to standardize some of these components of the nutrition labels, including the nutrition facts table as well as ingredients and et cetera. In 1992, the nutrition facts table then also became mandatory, and then it became relatively unchanged in the last about 25 years or so, until about 2003 when there was discussion about adding the trans fat information to the nutrition facts table. Yet, the last couple of years or so, there has been discussions about how can we improve or update the nutrition facts table. And so actually the current nutrition facts table that we all know very well is currently under revision, and I'll go over a few of the proposed changes in a little bit. Interestingly, there has been a fair global use in terms of what's required in mandatory nutrition labels around the world. So in 2007 here, the purple indicates the countries where the nutrition labels were mandatory for all prepackaged foods. And the yellow countries are those in which the nutrition labels were considered optional or voluntary. And unfortunately, all the white spaces are areas in which we have no information available. And we can see that in the years since that the use of nutrition labels have become mandatory, much more widespread throughout the world. So for the most part, we see here that the nutrition labels are mandatory in most parts of the North and South America, and are more voluntary in certain parts of Africa and Europe as well, including, for example, I think it's South Africa here and Switzerland, where it's still considered voluntary. I'll talk a little bit more about the types of nutrition labels that are used, but for the most part, the majority of these countries, even though they are required to use nutrition labels, for the most part, people who do use nutrition labels have them on what's known as a front of package label. On the back of package label, so that on the front you might see a nutrition claim, but on the back is where you would find ingredient list and the nutrition facts table. So approximately 85% of countries have the information on the back of the package, whereas a little bit less than half of food items have the information on the front of package. So I wanted to go over each one of those components of the nutrition labels one by one, and I'll focus more on this nutrition facts table, as this is, again, what I'll be discussing primarily in our research study. So even within this nutrition facts table, there are between 3 and 4 separate components that people normally use when they're looking at a nutrition facts table. The first component is really, what is the serving size and how many calories are contained in that one serving size? The next component are what's known as the core nutrients of the food product. And for the most part, those can be divided into both things that we are trying to potentially limit in our daily intake and those that we're trying to increase in our daily intake. So for example, most people are probably trying to limit the amount of cholesterol and sodium and fat that they consume, while on the other hand, most people are trying to increase the amount of nutrients such as fiber and vitamins that they are consuming. One additional component of the nutrition facts table is what's known as the percent daily value section here on the right. And this area here helps people determine whether or not that particular food product would be considered to have either high percent of the daily value or low percent of the daily value per food serving. So in general, we consider food items which have about 5% or less in the percent daily value to be considered low, and then food products that have 20% and above to be considered as a high percent of your daily value in that one serving. So despite the discussion about trying to standardize nutrition facts table, at least within the U.S., it's important to note that nutrition facts table do vary quite a bit around the world. So on the left here, we see the nutrition facts table and the ingredient list for Nutella. I think this is in the U.S. I see the .com down here. Oh, maybe it's in Canada, so it's made in Canada here. And this is probably the nutrition facts table that most of us are all familiar with. And on the right, we see a Nutella nutrition facts table for a country in Europe. And you can see a few differences. So not only, of course, are there different languages, which is not that important here, but we notice here, for example, that in comparison to the one for Canada, the U.S., the European countries tend to have separate sections of the nutrition facts table where one column will indicate the per consumption of a standardized measurement, which is generally 100 grams. And then they'll also include what's your consumption if you were just to consume one serving, which on here is 15 grams. And then on the far right, I don't know if you can see it very well, but then on the far right, they also include the percent daily value as well. There has been some research to suggest that consumers would prefer a nutrition facts table that's a little bit easier to comprehend and maybe a little bit more user-friendly in that way. And so there has been some research in looking at how do what's known as traffic lights or different symbols help a person not only use a nutrition label, but then also how does it help their comprehension as well. So, for example, these traffic lights have been are fairly good in terms of quickly informing somebody in terms of whether a particular nutrient would be considered to be low, medium, or high of that particular nutrient. And then there has been research done in by certain organizations, for example, the American Heart Association, to give essentially some food products a stamp of approval if they meet certain criteria for that, for what they consider to be standards of the food product. Nevertheless, even though these, for example, the traffic lights are an attempt to make things a little bit simpler for the consumer, there is a lot of embedded knowledge that would be necessary in order for the person to properly use the food product and the traffic lights. So, for example, for this food product here, we see that half a pack serving contains a medium amount of calories, low amount of sugar, and medium fat and salt, but also a high proportion of their saturated fat. But to understand what does low, medium, and high mean, the consumer would also need to understand what would be considered low, medium, and high. And you can see here on the right that the standards of what's considered low, medium, high differ on the food, differ on the nutrient as well. So, for example, something that's considered high for sugars would be over 15 grams per 100 gram serving, but for fat, it would be have to be over 20 grams of fat for 100 grams of a serving. So while the colors might be a quick way for a person to at least understand, are these all green? Are these all low or medium or high servings of a particular nutrient? It's not the full picture that they would need. In addition, despite the fact that essentially what the American Heart Association is trying to do is to help simplify the entire nutrition facts table so that all people have to do is really look for these certified labels on food products and to know that this food product meets a particular standard for the American Heart Association. Again, they are essentially embedding within the idea of the certification a lot of inherent additional information. So in order for a food product to be considered to be certified or to meet this criteria for the American Heart Association certification, the food must contain this type of information, with the total fat being less than 6.5 grams, for example, and saturated fat of 1 gram or less per serving, for example. And while these are some of the more main macronutrients that would be of interest, there's a little bit more fine print that's embedded as well. So, for example, these items with the asterisk, they have additional sort of requirements that are necessary. And so, for example, it also means that the type of fat needs to be not trans fat proportion, and, for example, it's more fine print. And then, in addition to that, there are additional specific requirements based on the type of food that it is as well. So, for example, maybe a particular bread product would meet certification according to these more general standards, except for the fact that since it is a bread product, there are some additional food category specific requirements for that item as well. So I talked a little bit before about some suggested changes that are being proposed for the nutrition facts table, and I wanted to go over those a little bit right now. So some of these changes include adding some additional information, such as how much added sugar is there in the product and how much vitamin D and potassium, for example. And at the same time, removing some information. So removing the information about how many calories from fat is included in that serving size, as well as the vitamin A and vitamin C content. And the two other pieces of information that might have fairly large implications in terms of how people use nutrition labels would be the updating of the serving size and what's known as a dual column label. And I'll talk a little bit about more on those on the next slide. So, for example, research has shown that a typical person's serving size is generally not the size that's recommended on the food product. So, for example, if we consider this to be a pint of ice cream, ice cream might say that inside this pint of ice cream there are a total of 4 servings, where each serving has 200 calories. But in reality, from the research studies, we find that most people do not eat the serving that's equivalent to that one serving size. If I think it's about 50 grams for that pint. And in general, most people have serving sizes that are a little bit larger than what's being suggested on the food item. So there has been some proposal to better reflect a person's true consumption of a food product by increasing the size of the serving size and then how that relates to the macronutrients on the nutrition facts table. And one additional change for that would be especially for beverages, in which case, for example, no matter what size beverage is purchased, the nutrition facts table should essentially consider the entire beverage to be a one serving. So rather than, for example, where you have a 20-ounce soda, it might say per serving size, and there's probably about three servings in that 20-ounce soda. The proposed change would be to, rather than saying there's three servings, just to indicate the one serving for the full 20 ounces of soda. And then one additional change that I briefly mentioned earlier was about the dual column labels. And this would be something that would be more aligned with some of the European labels that we saw earlier, where rather than just talking about the one serving size, there would now be a second column that would indicate how much of these macronutrients would you consume if you essentially ate this entire container, if you consumed this entire food product as one serving. So I just want to talk a little bit about what's currently understood from observational and experimental research before I talk more specifically about our research article. And there have been a number of systematic reviews that have found that, in general, people report a fairly high use of labels. So it's estimated around the world to be at least 50%, and of course that proportion varies based on the area. But in the U.S. it's about 75% and a little bit more than 50% in Canada. But as these are generally self-reported uses, there has been some research to suggest that, just like other things due to social desirability bias, for example, these self-report estimates tend to be an overestimate. And one study found that despite the fact that two-thirds of the participants said that they used food labels, they were less than 20% of them were actually observed using labels during the observational portion of that study. The people who are more likely to use labels do tend to be women compared to men. And then compared to adolescents and older-aged adults, the young adults and middle-aged adults tend to use the nutrition labels more often. Nutrition label use is also associated with having higher education levels and also higher income, and is also more commonly found among non-Hispanic whites as well. However, the reasons for a nutrition label use does tend to have quite a amount of variability in research. So, for example, it might include people who are not only have a personal preference or they essentially want to just maintain a healthy lifestyle, but it also might include people who are essentially changing their nutrition habits and their eating habits due to a recent health scare. So these people might normally have been considered to have poor nutrition habits and poor eating habits, but due to some recent diagnosis or on the advice of a healthcare professional, that they are now using nutrition labels. Unfortunately, for the most part, research that looked at nutrition label use in this way has been primarily cross-sectional. And so because of this sort of varying reasons for the use of nutrition label use, we, from a cross-sectional study, we'd be lumping together people who are trying to be healthier just as part of the general lifestyle, and we would be lumping them alongside people who are essentially needing to make those changes due to recent health scares. And as you can imagine, those two types of people would be quite different in terms of their other health habits and their cardiometabolic risk factors. There also has been some research in terms of not only how often do people use the labels, but are they actually processing the information correctly and understanding what kind of information is being contained on that nutrition label. And for the most part, we see that the portions where people have to do either some form of arithmetic or they have to sort of process the quantitative information are really the most difficult aspects of these nutrition labels for the consumers. And I'll talk a little bit more about our study in terms of what we found in terms of the accuracy of these areas of the nutrition labels for consumers as well. There have been some encouraging evidence to suggest that the literacy does seem to be higher for people who are now using traffic lights and symbols as on their nutrition labels. But the literature also suggests that that might be somewhat of a superficial understanding. So, for example, they essentially are looking for the color coding schemes of traffic lights to determine whether something is better than the other, which might not be the full picture in terms of a comparison between food products. And lastly, we see from the observational research that people who do use the nutrition labels do tend to have healthier eating habits. In And actually, this is due to the fact that for the most part, people report using the nutrition labels or the nutrition facts tables more specifically in order to essentially look for certain macronutrients that they're trying to avoid. So, for example, somebody who's trying to lose weight might be looking specifically at the fat and the calorie content, whereas somebody who's trying to decrease their cholesterol intake would be looking at the cholesterol section of the facts table. And, in fact, we do see that, in general, they do have at least healthier consumption in terms of their fat, cholesterol, salt, and energy. And as you can imagine, there's been some research to show that where this nutrition facts information is on the food product also has a major impact as well. And so for the most part, if you put the information on the front of the package, that does seem to have a larger effect on a person's food purchasing habits as well as their eating habits than if you were to essentially put it on the back of the products where it might not be as easily seen. However, this is fairly preliminary in terms of this research, and the results are fairly mixed as well. And as I mentioned earlier, as the majority of products are actually back-of-product packaging, it would be quite a shift to change all the food packaging to have front-of-package labels instead. In terms of experimental research, this has been a two-part kind of research here. So for example, there has been some experimental research that would compare the consumption of particular food products in, for example, a restaurant before and after some new regulation that required the nutrition labeling and the nutrition facts table in the restaurant. And for the most part, we see that for adults, if they're at a restaurant and there's either a pre-regulation and a post-regulation in which the nutrition facts table then became visible to the consumers, that did have a beneficial effect on their consumption of especially calories and fat. And in addition, we see that when you do the same type of studies for families, parents who see the nutrition facts tables tend to order foods for their children that are about approximately 100 calories less than if they don't know the nutrition facts information. But these are only a few studies that have been published so far. And in addition, the results on the parents' meals are a little bit more mixed, whereas if they might choose something that's a little bit healthier for the child or it has a little bit less calories for the child, they may not necessarily make the same changes for themselves. And the literature so far suggests that at least for children and adolescents, even though they may notice the labels when you provide it as a pre and post in experimental study, it doesn't actually have an effect on their consumption of the food products. But there is some evidence to suggest that perhaps this effect on the calorie consumption might also be due to the setting of where the study is being conducted, where researchers have found that children are more likely to pay attention to the nutrition facts labels and if they're in a cafeteria setting or in a larger school setting than if they were in a restaurant setting with their family. And the developmental literature does suggest that there is a fairly large influence on the parents on their children's nutrition. And this can be done through several different ways. So, for example, the parents are really their child's first model in terms of the types of foods that they would be consuming in the household. And then also, as the caregiver, the parent does have the main authority on what types of foods are available in the house and what types of foods are being purchased. And these types of decisions and these types of behaviors that are developed during childhood can have long-standing effects where the child will essentially carry this forward into adulthood. But there's very little research in terms of how do these parent and child dyads or how do these relationships in terms of the parent's nutritional use affect their children's health. As I mentioned on the previous slide, for the most part, these studies that have looked at the parental influence on their children's food consumption have been primarily experimental and focused on essentially how do the calorie consumptions differ if you provide a nutrition facts table versus if you do not. And there's very little research in terms of how did this nutrition facts table use and their literacy affect the other health associations in the children. So this became our underlying research question for the study that I'll talk about a little bit more today. And in particular, we wanted to know how do the use of the nutrition facts table, as well as the parents' understanding of the nutrition facts table, how is that associated with both their own health, but also the health of their children? I just want to talk a little bit about the study population. It was a convenient sample that contained approximately 134 parent-child dyads from a baseline measurement of a cohort study here in Montreal. And the main eligibility criteria were that children needed to be within a particular age range. And I'll talk a little bit more about that at the end. But for the most part, children were in the middle school age, around 12 and a half. And both parents and youth needed to be without serious psychopathology or cardiovascular disease events. And because we did have a considerable amount of data being collected among the parents as well as the children, we needed at least one parent to be available for these study measurements. So I want to talk a little bit more about each one of these factors of our independent variable on the subsequent slides. And so I'll go over what we consider to be part of the nutrition facts, stable use, their literacy, and also their knowledge. So we identify label users in terms of the nutrition facts table use as people who reported that they either often or almost always read the nutrition label and also use the nutrition labels for making purchasing decisions and eating decisions. And then essentially for everybody else who either used only one of these components, like they, for example, only read the labels but they didn't make any purchasing decisions or eating decisions based on the label, or they only use them sporadically, these were considered our non-label users. For our nutrition label literacy, we had 20 questions which covered four different types of literacy. And I'll go over each one of those separately. So the most basic portion of the nutrition label literacy was understanding the basic nutrition table information. So, for example, one of the questions showed a picture of Campbell's tomato soup and asked the participant, if you ate one serving of soup, how much cholesterol would you consume? Where the answer was an open-ended short answer question. The second source of literacy that we assessed was the participant's understanding of the sources of calories. So here, for example, we would show a different nutrition facts table and ask the participants to indicate how many calories would you get from saturated fat if you ate one serving of this food. A third type of information would be for the participant to be able to essentially convert or to do some arithmetic on some of this information. So if we provided the nutrition facts for one serving and we asked them to now determine how many grams of fiber would they consume if they had two portions of the food. And the last type of literacy that we wanted to assess was the participant's ability to compare different labels. So if we showed two different labels here where we see some small differences in terms of, I think it's in the some of the content here, we could see that, for example, which one of these muffins would you choose to maximize your fiber intake, where that was really the only one item on the nutrition facts table which was changed. And we could see here on the right that the nutrition facts for this muffin on the right had slightly higher dietary fiber compared to the one on the left. The nutrition knowledge was assessed using the subscale of choosing everyday foods, which was validated by Parmenter-Wardell. And a couple sample questions, and we can go over all the questions at the end if people wish, but a couple of these questions might be, for example, if a person wanted to reduce the amount of fat in their diet, which would be their best choice? And then we would give them a couple options for them to select. Our dependent measures included both anthropometric measures, which included BMI, waist circumference, and percent body fat. And for children, because they're expected to essentially change their BMIs over time due to their developmental changes, we then converted their BMIs to the CDC standardized measurements and calculated their BMI centiles and their Z-scores. In addition, both parents and children, we assessed cardiometabolic measures, including their total cholesterol, HDL, LDL, triglycerides, as well as their blood pressure values. And in addition, our analyses also adjusted for the following covariates. And I just wanted to also mention that the covariates that were adjusted for were for that particular study participant. So, for example, in the models that assessed the parents' cardiometabolic risk measures, we included the parental measures. And then for the children, we included, for example, the child's age and the child's sex. And just so that we're all on the same page, I just wanted to briefly show you what are the recommended cardiometabolic levels in both parents and children. So for parents, for example, or in other words, adults, total cholesterol should be less than 200 milligrams per deciliter, and so on. And we can see that for children, although there's not as standard of a criteria that's been developed for children in comparison to adults, this has been one published guideline in terms of what would be considered to be appropriate or recommended levels for children. So our data analysis included separate analyses for the parents from the children. And because we didn't see any sort of evidence of a high collinearity or multicollinearity between our nutrition label use, the label literacy, and nutrition knowledge, we included all three in our predictors, as predictors in our models. And our measurements for the cardiometabolic measures additionally adjusted for BMI, which again, since BMI was in some ways some of our dependent measures in our anthropometric measures, we did not adjust for BMI. And we additionally adjusted for some other variables as well, such as household income and the parental levels of physical activity. But since these measures were not available in all participants and their results were largely unaffected, these were excluded from our final analysis. So I just want to go over a few of the descriptive statistics here. So, for example, we see that the majority of parents who responded to our questionnaire were essentially the mothers. About 20% were male and the rest were the mothers of the children. And in comparison, the children were about 50-50 male and female. The proportion of parents who were overweight or obese was, I guess, right on target with what would be considered overweight and obese statistics in the U.S., about 50%, which I believe it's a little bit less than the two-thirds estimated in the U.S. And the youth were approximately 30% of them were overweight or obese, which is consistent with what's found in the U.S. You just note here that based on some of their cardiovascular biomarkers, we see at least two specific cardiometabolic measures which were above or at least not at the level that's just recommended for the parents. In particular, their HDL was a little bit lower than what's recommended, and their LDL is a little bit higher than the 100 milligrams per deciliter that's recommended for parents. We didn't see any type of abnormal levels on average in the children. So we found that about 40% of the parents reported using nutrition labels, and these were our participants who were identified as nutrition label users. And in contrast, there was a much smaller proportion of youth and adolescents who reported using nutrition labels consistently. Unfortunately, the nutrition label literacy and nutrition knowledge was not measured in children, and so we don't have any information on that. But in the adults, we see that on average, the parents were about 70% accurate on the nutrition label literacy, but we can see that there's quite an amount of variation in terms of which were the ones which were very accurate and which ones were the parents had the most trouble with the values. And we see here, for example, that the one with the lowest accuracy was identifying the calorie sources and also comparing different labels to one another. And on average, the nutrition knowledge was a little bit better than 50%, about 60% accuracy on the nutrition knowledge questions. And we see that based on the parental use of the nutrition facts tables and the nutrition facts literacy and also the nutrition knowledge, we found that there was really no associations with any three of these components and any anthropometric measures in the parents here, based on their BMI, waist circumference, or percent body fat. But in youth, we see that, for example, if a parent had higher label literacy, their child actually had a higher BMI centile and Z-score. And if the parent had high nutrition knowledge, this had an inverse association so that the children had lower BMI centiles and Z-scores and other anthropometric measures. Oh, I just wanted to mention that if you are following along with the news of the publication, I've converted these all to milligrams per deciliter just because I believe that's probably the more standard way to measure cholesterol and cardiometabolic measures in the U.S. And so these numbers are not going to be the same as what you see in the article, but the associations are the same. And I have, just for anybody who wants to have the exact numbers as shown in the article, the following slide, the subsequent slide, has the millimoles per liter. So in contrast to what we saw with the anthropometric measures, we saw that parents who did use labels did have lower total cholesterol levels and thus lower total cholesterol HDL ratios, but their LDL was also higher. In addition, the parents who had better label literacy had more favorable total cholesterol, and if they had higher knowledge, they also had slightly worse total cholesterol levels as well. And in contrast to what we saw with anthropometric measures, we really saw no associations with the parents' nutrition label use, literacy, and knowledge on their children's cardiometabolic measures. So in general, we found some mixed results, but also some consistent findings in terms of seeing that the parental nutrition label use was really associated with the parents' cardiometabolic risk factors, but not the parents' anthropometric measures, and we essentially found the opposite being true for the parents' nutrition label use and their children's anthropometric measures. It's so far, to us at least, it's unclear whether the results that we found reflect actually underlying different associations, or if it reflected some measurement error, or in addition, if it meant for perhaps that for children at least, that they're still too early in the natural history of cardiovascular disease risk, and so we cannot actually identify any cardiometabolic risk factors in that young age range. However, the study is not without its limitations. And I'm happy to go over these in a little bit more detail as well. But for the most part, some of these limitations were due to the fact that the way the data was collected was a combination of parental report and also proxies, which were used for body fat rather than using DEXA, which is the gold standard for measuring body composition. Another limitation of some of our nutrition measurements is actually a limitation of the literature in general. So, for instance, really the literature that's been assessing nutrition label use is still quite crude. People tend to just essentially use a generic measurement about how often do you use nutrition labels to help guide your purchasing decisions, for example. But they're fairly shortened questionnaires that don't really pertain to a particular time frame. And because they don't pertain to a particular time frame, and that study was a cross-sectional design, we're not quite sure on whether or not any recent changes in nutrition label use might have affected some of the cardiometabolic risk factors. In addition, our small sample size really did prevent us from being able to look at some of the follow-up measurements in the sample. So, for instance, I think it's about 134 participants who were involved in the baseline measurement. We had a little bit less than half of them who had completed the follow-up, and so we really couldn't assess any changes in their measurements over time. And lastly, in particular, because the children were about 10 to 15 age, on average they were in the middle school age, we didn't unfortunately have any type of measurements about their own label literacy and their own nutrition knowledge. And it might be that, for instance, at these ages, especially as they're getting older, that their own nutrition habits and their nutritional label use and knowledge is more relevant for their own health than their parents. So in terms of some of the conclusions from the study and some future directions that we would like to see the literature take, is that although the majority of the parents in our study did report using nutrition labels, we did find a considerable amount of incorrect or inaccurate understanding of some of these nutrition labels. And this does suggest that there is a need for at least either simplifying the nutrition labels to a point where they're more understandable, or some increased education efforts so that people are understanding them correctly. And as I mentioned on the previous slide, some of the research limitations of our study are actually general limitations of just nutrition literature in general. In particular, the way we are measuring nutrition label use and literacy, there's quite a lot of variability, and there's really no standardized measurement in the way that researchers try to identify nutrition label use. In particular, it would be nice to be able to capture some of these changes over time through longitudinal studies. And this would be a much better sense of how does a person's nutrition label use from last year, for example, how does that affect their health today or their health in the future, rather than trying to assess their current associations based on a cross-sectional measurement. So this paper was published along with two of my colleagues here, Jennifer McGrath from the Department of Psychology at Concordia University, and Stephanie Houle-Johnson, who is now at the University of Ottawa. And I'd like to also acknowledge all the Healthy Heart Project participants who continue to be involved with the study data collection, as well as the funding sources for this for the data collection as well. And I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you for that presentation. We're taking questions now if you have anything to submit. I did have one comment asking if you would share all 10 of the questions that you used to assess nutrition knowledge at the end.
Oh, sure.
So that's
actually another limitation of the study. So this original study, the Parmenter-Wardell study from 1999, they actually had four different subscales in which they measured essentially some nutrition literacy. And we only used this one choosing everyday food subscale because that was what was in the data collection. And you can see that the Cronbach's alpha and the test-retest reliability is a little bit lower in this item compared to the other ones. But overall, the scale is decent, and we can look at all the questions in a little bit more detail right now. So, for example, the other questions included which would be the best choice for low-fat, high-fiber snack, and the participant would have to select from these items. One thing that I did like about this subscale was that even though there obviously are a lot more variations in terms of food products nowadays compared to 1999, I feel like the responses that would be true today are still, that were true back in 1999 will be still true today as well. And it's mainly because they tend to have like one or two words that's kind of the key word in each one of the questions. So, for example, if we go to that one about the steak, or if you want to reduce the amount of fat in your diet, which would be the best choice. But even though everything is grilled, they do give you a variation in terms of either it's a steak or pork chop or sausages, and then the item which would probably have the least amount of fat, which would be the turkey that's grilled. So these are the first five questions of that subscale. And I believe these are also in the version that I uploaded, but I'm not quite sure. I'll have to double check because these were additional slides. I'm not sure. I can always upload those if people would like those. And then the last five questions are here on this next slide here.
So while people are looking at those questions, I have a question related to the label reading question. So I know you gave an example of one of the questions, or a couple of the questions actually, and I wonder to what extent a person's mathematics literacy or skill sets impact their ability to decipher, interpret, and then apply labels when they're working.
Yeah, that's a great question, and I think that's one of the key limitations of this literature in general. Because just as you notice, if they just subtracted incorrectly, for example, or they were off by one digit, they were marked as wrong incompletely, even though maybe it was just either as an arithmetic error or it was just a transpose error and they understood the question. But there's really no way for us to know whether or not it's one of those other reasons. And so, unfortunately, they're all identified as people who missed the question instead. So I completely agree with you that I think some of the literature that indicates that this quantitative information is the hardest, that might actually have to do more with numerical literacy rather than the nutritional label literacy.
Does anyone else have any questions? Okay, I'll ask one more from my end. Was there any background research, and forgive me if I missed this, or anything in your study that really showed what pieces of information on the food labels people are using the most? For instance, you mentioned they are removing some information around calcium and percent fat. What pieces of a label do people tend to use to actually make decisions and other parts that they tend to ignore?
Yeah, I think it all depends on what their purpose of using label is in the first place. So, for example, people who are, I think I mentioned this earlier, but people who are trying to lose weight, they tend to look for the calories and the fat information, whereas people who are looking to reduce their salt intake would mainly look at the sodium intake instead. People who are just trying to be eating healthier in general tend to look at the whole picture, but those who are have a specific goal in mind for either losing weight or cutting cholesterol, they would particularly just look for the item that they're most interested in.
I wonder how many actually use the percent vitamin, you know, percent calcium, and, well, of course, calcium's going, but vitamin A, those kinds of things that might show up sort of down at the bottom, how many actually apply.
Yeah, and there's been, yeah, I mean, not in our research, but there has been some research that use eye tracking to see where on the nutrition labels do people tend to look. And for the most part, they are looking more at the macronutrients, and they just sort of skim over all the percent daily value information. But that's where sort of the different traffic lights and the different symbols come into play a little bit more, because those tend to keep the person's eye on the item or the nutrient a little bit longer than just a nutrition facts table, at least a more traditional way.
It's interesting. Well, I think that's all our questions, unless anyone has a last-minute question. Thank you so much for your time today and for everyone who called in to participate in the webinar. Thank you, Dr. Hakanami, for your presentation. Rachel,
yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah, just a reminder that when I close out the webinar, there'll be a short survey, and we appreciate your feedback. And watch for an email from me by Wednesday that has a link to the recording, the CEU certificate, and the slides again. And I'll double check. We'll make sure that these questions are included in the slides that are sent out as in a follow-up. And then we'll look for everyone back next Monday for Journal Club, Self-Weighing Throughout Adolescence and Young Adulthood, Implications for Well-Being. And then just a reminder, we are working on finalizing the schedule for the spring semester Journal Club, which will be Policies, Systems, and Environmental Change Initiatives. Looks like we're going to start on February the 6th. And I'm very excited that I think I only need about one or two more presenters, and we'll be able to send out the schedule. So thank you, everyone, and we'll look for you next Monday.